Is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, June 10th, 2022. And today will be better than yesterday. Taylor Schwenk is not here today. Sarah Abbott's running the ship today from Bristol. Sarah, what's going on?
Nothing much. Just, you know, hanging out. I'm really excited to be running the ship, but I always miss Taylor. It feels weird. It feels like we're missing a link.
That's not what you said before the show started. I could tell you're hungry for power. So I'm just going to get out of the way. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my home in New York. Sarah, can I get a hallelujah?
Hallelujah.
The Angels losing streak is over because of Shohei Ohtani, who was hitting.
Drives that one. Hit well. Shohei Ohtani has done it.
And he was pitching.
And he got it. Look at that emotion. Shohei. Oh, 98.
That was the sound of Ohtani giving a scream after he struck out Jackie Bradley Jr. The Angels win 5-2. Their 14-game losing streak is over. Streaking the other way, the Atlanta Braves, who faced the Pirates yesterday. Dansby Swanson got a big hit.
Looks at Acuna, comes back to the plate, and it's blooped to right. Going to fall. Base hit. Acuna waved around third. He will score easily on the RBI single by Swanson.
That sound from 680, the fan. The Braves have now won 8 in a row and are 6.5 games out of first place right behind them. The Phillies, who are also streaking, they haven't lost since making a change in manager. Rob Thompson came in a week ago, and they've been winning every single day, including on Thursday when Bryce Harper went deep.
Swing and fly ball out to center. Deep back, Taylor still back, and Bryce Harper with his second home run in as many days.
That sound from Sports Radio 94 WIP. Hot Ticket is brought to you by Vivid Seats, where you earn rewards with every purchase. Vivid Seats Rewards is your ticket to more tickets. Vivid Seats, life happens live. The Twins played host to the Yankees on Thursday, and for Gerrit Cole, it was not a good night.
High fly to deep right field. Going back is Gallo. We are tied. And now Buxton drives one to left field. And just like that, the Twins are on top. And now Correa drives it to left. A drive to left. He has another one. Put on a show, Byron Buxton.
Ooh.
Larmick pays off. Deep to right center field. Will it ever come down?
Gerrit Cole's final pitching line, 5 homers and 7 runs allowed in 2 1/3 innings. But you know what? The Yankees came back with ex-twin Aaron Hicks delivering the game-tying hit in the top of the 6th inning.
Hicks launches that down the right field line. This game is tied.
Here's what happened with the score tied 7-7 in the top of the 7th inning.
Rizzo pokes it the other way. A base hit. Judge rounding third. Heading home. He scores.
The Yankees get 2 home runs from Joey Gallo in this game. They win 10-7. They are 41-16. There's a lot of conversation in baseball around a decision made by Tony La Russa in the White Sox and Dodgers game yesterday. The Dodgers led 7-5 in the top of the 6th inning. Trey Turner was at the plate. Freddie Freeman moved to second on a wild pitch. The count shifting to 1-2, and that's when La Russa decided to intentionally walk Trey Turner. Give a listen, ESPN 1000.
So 1-2 on Trey Turner, and they will intentionally walk him with Muncy on deck. So first and second.
After that, Max Muncy did this.
High fly ball the other way. Pollock's going back. It's gone! 3-run home.
So the Dodgers win the game 11-9, and after the game, La Russa was asked about that decision to intentionally walk Turner.
Turner was a strike left against a left-hander is not something you can avoid if you can. And we had an open base, and Muncy happened to be the guy behind him, and that's a better matchup. Here again, somebody disagrees, that's the beauty of this game. Welcome to it. But that wasn't a tough call.
Now, there's some numbers that actually back up what La Russa did, and I'll be talking about those with Paul Hembekides coming up. Sarah, what else do you have?
Thank you, Buster. Be sure to check out The Low Post. It's bringing you some of the best insights into the world of the NBA, hosted by Zach Lowe. Zach is joined by Brian Windhorst for a special post-game podcast this NBA Finals. So be sure to check that out because we have game four tonight. Also, be sure to check out The Greatest Mixtape Ever. It's a story of how streetball videos set to music in the 90s transformed basketball's place and culture, defined the lives of the players who starred in them, and changed the game itself forever. Stream now on ESPN Plus and listen to the companion 30 for 30 podcast, a streetball mixtape exploring the essence of streetball through a collection of legendary stories. Listen now on Spotify and wherever you get your podcasts.
Jumping into the numbers. This is Hembo Knows on Baseball Tonight.
Hembo with Paul Imbecides, a researcher at ESPN who's a honcho on the show Get Up and in charge of everything. And that today, Hembo, includes being the best friend in the world to Tony La Russa. Because when I texted you this morning and asked you for some data behind his decision yesterday, you know what? Maybe there was some rationale behind it.
There's no question, Buster. When I saw this yesterday, I had the same initial reaction as everyone else, which is, what the heck is Tony La Russa doing intentionally walking a batter with two strikes? This is baseball in 2022. Nobody can hit with two strikes, right? Well, not really. To be honest with you, Trey Turner is an excellent hitter. And even in the context of his circumstances, I'm not so sure it was the wrong decision given the information he had at the time. Buster, after the count reaches 1-2 for Trey Turner, this season he's 5-15. That's a small sample size. Over the last three seasons, he's batting .362 with a .638 slug in this exact situation after a 1-2 count against a left-handed pitcher. So that's enough of a sample that says, you know what? He might do some serious damage here. Not to mention the fact that Max Muncy was 5-4-40 against left-handed pitching, obviously, on deck. Now, does that mean I think Tony La Russa made the right decision? I don't know. Look, these things are so much easier to judge after they happen. But given all the information that I just laid out, I understand what Tony was doing. Now, I think the obvious kickback here is there's two outs. You're not setting up a double play. There's a left-handed hitter that's coming up to the plate. That's obviously not part of the discussion. But on its face, Trey Turner still excels in the exact situation in which he was in. Max Muncy is awful in the exact situation he was in. Sometimes, Buster, you can hit a good putt without it going in.
Right. And I think if you're sitting in Tony's position, and I'm you know, everything you said, I agree with. I think I would have made a different decision than Tony did, but there was certainly data behind it. And I think as he's sitting there, he's thinking, okay, who's more likely to get ahead, Trey Turner or Max Muncy, based on the information? There's no question it's Trey Turner.
and thus there's no question that he made the right decision. And I have to admit, Buster, it really irked me to read literally hundreds of tweets from keyboard warriors, people that think they know more about baseball than someone who's won nearly 3,000 games in the big leagues. Look, Tony La Russa is a Hall of Fame manager. Tony La Russa has forgotten more about baseball than any of those people will ever know. Again, I'm with you. I don't know that I would have made that decision. In fact, I probably wouldn't have had the guts to. But that's the difference between Tony La Russa and everybody else. And if you can make the right decision 55% of the time as a manager, you're going to go to the Hall of Fame. He's obviously there. I bet you he slept just fine last night with the decision that he made. Of that, I'm confident in saying.
I would say this. If I were covering the White Sox today, the conversation that I would have with Tony would be, you know what? A lot of those numbers may not necessarily apply with the left-hander he had on the mound at that moment. Bennett Susu, who's the pitcher, is not a shutdown lefty so far in his career. Lefties have an OPS over 800. So that would
be the
one part that I would say, you know what I mean? As you're sort of factoring in all these things, that would be the one question I would have with Tony. All that data maybe doesn't apply with this particular left-hander.
Totally fair. But on the contrary, Buster, the worst argument you can make today is the league's only hitting 160 within two strike counts this year. You know what? The league is not Trey Turner. He's way better than the league average hitter. And you know what? Trey Turner is hitting with a platoon advantage. All right. And this is what makes baseball great. Every decision comes with a terabyte of data points. And look, that's what makes this thing so fun. But do I think the fact that Max Muncy hit a home run means that Tony La Russa made the wrong decision? Absolutely, unequivocally not.
You know, a week ago, Tony La Russa would have been in the conversation for maybe the best manager in the history of baseball, but that's not the case anymore. Rob Thompson clearly is undefeated. The Phillies never lose with Rob in the dugout.
But Buster, contrary to popular sabermetric belief, the only thing that matters in baseball, as we now know, is who's managing the team. That is what these Phillies prove. I want to take you back a week ago when you and I think, sort of shared the same thought here, which was, you know, firing Joe Girardi was putting lipstick on a pig. The Phillies don't have a good roster, and the Phillies firing Joe Girardi is just something to do that says we did something. Well, I guess it shows how much I know in that context, because they're 6-0 since the firing. They've scored 47 runs and allowed 14 runs. It's the team's best run differential in any six-game span since May of 2008. The Phillies won the World Series, of course, that season. And a glimmer of hope as we move forward here, because, of course, the Phillies are going to lose again sometime soon, probably this weekend. Philly has played the most difficult schedule in the National League to date, and moving forward, only the Cardinals own an easier one. Now, I don't necessarily think the Phillies are on the fast track to the playoffs by any stretch of the imagination. But like you said, I mean, Rob Thompson is now at least equal to, if not greater than, Connie Mack.
But the Phillies might be the third best team in the division. And according to you, the second best team might be the New York Mets in the National League East. How come?
Because as baseball gambling becomes more and more popular, Buster, I'm just always sort of on the lookout now for numbers or lines or odds that jump out to me. And I found one yesterday, and I wanted to present to you and your listeners. That number is plus 300. Plus 300. That is the number that you can get the Braves at to win the National League East. They're 3-1. In my opinion, outstanding value for a team this good. Here's my logic. So right now they're 6.5 games back. Last year there were as many as 8 games back in the middle of June. We know that lead was not insurmountable, so there's some history there. Going back to 2019 now, and I'm going to exclude 2020 because it was only a 60-game season, Atlanta is 2 games under 500 through the month of May, 53 games over from June on. So there's a track record of slow starts in hot summers, Buster. And lastly, look, Ronald Acuna is a singular force, a singular force. The Braves have played 58 games this season, 29 with him, 29 without him. With Ronald Acuna, they're 18-11. They average nearly 5 runs a game. Without him, they're 13-16 and average just over 4. That gap, Buster, is equivalent to the difference between the number one offense in baseball and the number 23 offense in baseball. This team is on the fast track to making it a very competitive division. And I don't think a 6.5 game lead that the Mets have right now is anything approximating insurmountable.
In talking about the Braves, you didn't mention my new favorite player, Michael Harris II. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
One thing about Alex Anthopoulos, the general manager of the Braves, who I think we've learned that he is willing to make changes. Like, he's pliable in terms of what they need and what they have. And it was clear midway through last year he needed to bolster the outfield, but he also was like, you know what, I'm going to add power. Jock Peterson, Jorge Soler, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I kind of like the shift in the middle of this year's team to defense. Because when I watched the Braves early on, and, you know, with all due respect to Adam Duvall, you know, plays a terrific corner outfielder, him playing center field, no. And now when you watch them play and they got Acuna in right field, back healthy, and you got Harris in center field, wow.
Yeah, I mean, this kid was so good that they were willing to include Christian Pache in the trade to Oakland for Matt Olson. And one of the reasons why I think Atlanta's very much a player here is because I'm not sure there's any general manager in the sport right now that does a better job of diagnosing how good his team is and how good his team isn't than Anthopoulos. In my judgment, his season last year, during his mid-season acquisitions, were as good as Theo Epstein's in 2004. We're talking about a legendary executive season. This team is going to get a lot better throughout the course of the season. Look, if the Mets win 100 games, they might wind up winning the East. But there is very little margin for error there. Definitely not 6.5 games worth.
The Yankees yesterday saw their starting pitcher give up 5 home runs in the first 3 innings, and yet they came back and won again with the home run. What are you seeing there?
So, Buster, there are any number of reasons why the Yankees are just blowing past my expectations for them. But perhaps most importantly, they're winning because they're hoarding baseball's most valuable currency. That, of course, is home runs. Here's what I mean. The Yankees have, despite last night, they've out-homered their opponent by 41 through 57 games. That's a differential of plus 116 over the course of a full season. Some context for that. The 1927 Yankees, not surprisingly, owned the record, if you will. That was plus 116. The 1961 Yankees, you know, Maris, Mantle, they were plus 103. Look, I got to tip my cap to Brian Cashman. That guy knows how to build a baseball team.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And by the way, for more context on 1927, if I remember correctly, that year Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs and he had more home runs than any other team, just the individual player, correct?
Babe Ruth, the year in which Babe Ruth out-homered every other team in the American League was 1921. But in 1927, he and the Yankees constituted like a huge percentage of the American League. Obviously, that's not the case anymore. But I think it sort of underscores exactly how special this group is. If you can out-homer your opponent to this degree, almost one per game, you're going to win way more baseball games than you lose. Now, we don't know if that's necessarily a durable or sustainable formula come, say, October. But look, home runs are where money is made now in Major League Baseball. And right now the Yankees hit them and suppress them better than any team in the sport. And that is hard to do.
All right, Hembo. Hey, good luck in your conversations with your wife about naming one of your forthcoming children after Rob Thompson. You know, I know you'll figure out a way to make that happen.
Yes, Rob Thompson. And then perhaps, I mean, we're having two daughters, so this is going to be tricky. But, I mean, I think LaRussa Hembakita sounds pretty good.
All right, Hembo, thanks.
Later, man.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Jessica Mendoza is an analyst for ESPN, and Jess, you're going to have to carry me today.
Like physically? You're not able to walk?
You're going to have to carry this segment because peek behind the curtain. It's Thursday afternoon when I'm taping with you because you got a crazy busy schedule at the college softball World Series. And I was at the McCartney concert last night at Fenway Park. I drove all the way back to New York afterward. I got home at 2:30, then got a call from my daughter at 4:30 from she's traveling in Europe and had an issue she needed help with. So I'm just going to put topics on the table. You're going to talk and I'm going to see if I can sort of put together your thoughts because my brain is scrambled right now.
Yeah, I really feel bad for you with the Paul McCartney concert and the fact that your daughter's in Europe. That's rough.
Yeah, I texted you at the beginning of that concert last night, and I was like, hey, I'm at the McCartney concert, and you were kind of pissed off.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a huge Paul McCartney fan. I was like 10 minutes to air, and I get this video of Paul McCartney in like awesome seats, and I was like, seriously, Buster?
All right, so here are the topics. Weighted runs created. Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, it's just like we see with a lot of these weighted, you know, WOBA, you know, weighted on base average.
Statistics. It's a statistic. Yeah.
Yeah. The sabermetrics and what, you know, I think how it can put it in perspective. And what I love about it is with weighted runs created plus, and a lot of when you add that plus, it basically makes it above or below average. So 100 is average. Anything below or above that is really good or really bad. And so it kind of makes it like dumbs it down a little bit, if that makes sense. But what I love about it is, you know, covering the Women's College World Series right now, it also allows us to go across softball and baseball because of how many runs a player is creating. It's actually been the biggest offensive stat that we've seen now the last 2 years. So Jocelyn Allo, who, by the way, is the home run queen. She hit two more last night. She's hit four home runs in two games here at the Women's College World Series. So like the toughest competition that you're going to face. If you haven't heard her name, you're pretty much living under a rock at this point. But her weighted runs created plus is at 303, which is like mind-blowing. And to put that in perspective, in MLB history, the highest weighted runs created plus is actually 244 by Barry Bonds back in 2004. So just to think, you know, and Aaron Judge this year, he's leading and he broke 200. He's at 202 right now, which most guys, when they're at like their peak having insane seasons, they're in like the 170 to 190 range. So not to nerd out, but I'm just trying to give the perspective of the amount of runs that a player can create. And right now, Jocelyn Allo is at a 303, meaning she's 200% more than MLB average, and honestly, 59% more than Barry Bonds in 04 for everything that he was in that season. And so I just wanted to give it that perspective, because not only has she hit 121 home runs, but she's also batting 500 on the season, not like the last week or the last 2 weeks, small sample size. No, we're talking almost 80 games and she's hitting 500 on the season. So to me, like that nerdy stat, but I love it honestly for baseball and softball, because it's the perfect way to explain how much a player is producing runs. At the end of the day, if you want to win games, you got to produce runs. And right now, Jocelyn Allo is at the top.
Yeah, so she's like Babe Ruth and Shohei Ohtani put together. And I know you're competitive enough to know that you might know the answer to this question. What was your WRC plus in college?
Oh, my gosh. I actually have no idea.
You know what? Actually, it's funny. I'm kidding about you, you know, being aware of those stats. You need to talk about that on like the next broadcast, you know, or have the producers put it up and have you guess what your number is. That's going to be either being really incredibly cool for you or incredibly disappointing, right?
Yeah, or like really humbling, being like, God, I thought I was good, but well, I know it's no Jocelyn Allo, but I'm sure it was decent. It's just crazy to think about though, because it is a cool way to understand your total package and what you're doing to produce.
I completely agree with you. I love that stat. So the Angels, in the midst of this losing streak, firing their manager Joe Maddon, they bring in Phil Nevin. Yesterday, somebody in the organization thought it was a good idea with a 13-game losing streak to change the walk-up music for all the players. And I don't know who ordered this. I don't think it was Phil Nevin, if you know his personality. My guess, it wasn't Perry Manassian, their general manager, but somebody thought it was a good idea. I got to say, when I saw that, Jess, I'm like, no, don't do stuff like that. And I go back to a conversation I had with Joe Torre when I covered the Yankees. And I asked him, I said, hey, when you're in a long losing streak, did you believe in stuff like draw the lineup out of a hat, you know, mix stuff up, do this or do that? He goes, nope, you don't do it. Because what happens if you do that and then you lose? Then it just feels silly and dumb. And so Joe's belief was, you might do something like send a coach up, different coach up to with a lineup card, but don't change anything. Put in your work, believe in the process, because that's ultimately what you're going to have to trust. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I am actually for mixing things up. I am a big, you know, superstition type, but I think like you kind of have to come up with it on your own and not have it thrown at you. Like you have your walk up, like guys have superstitions, and to do something like complete blank across the board. And I know it seems silly. It's a song that you walk up to and it's just mixing up. But to me, like, you can't mess with mojo on the individual. Like, everyone has their thing. And if they want to mix that up, kudos, go for it. Like, do something different. But you don't force it on people. I mean, the superstition part of baseball is insane. And especially pitchers, which they also change their music to. I mean, that's when it's almost like bringing to light and even more attention. Like, hey, by the way, you guys have been awful. So now we're going to go ahead and just change everything for everybody and make that you're hyper aware of this, even when you're walking up to your bat or coming out of the bullpen.
What was your walk-up music?
I had a lot of AC/DC.
All right.
What
happened to you? You're an old soul. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Oh, no, for sure. And Bon Scott, AC/DC. So we're going like back AC/DC. And then All Right Now for Free sometimes, because that's Stanford's fight song, which is pretty cool because we're the only school with like a classic rock fight song. And then every now and then I'd mix in some like Latin music too, because I'd like salsa dance my way in the batter's box, depending on how I was feeling.
Oh, man, that's awesome. All right. Nathan Eovaldi, tell me what you're seeing in him of the Red Sox. Obviously, part of the Red Sox turnaround recently.
Yeah, no, I mean, the velocity's been down. I know that was a concern. That's why Alex Cora, I think he called timeout fifth inning in the game yesterday. But I think, you know, the biggest thing I notice, Buster, sometimes with guys when their velo goes down, sometimes we think it's a big injury. For him, it's been like hip tightness, so it's not a huge worry of something going on with his arm or his shoulder. But something he talked about, and I've heard a lot of pitchers talk about, is when the velocity isn't there, there's such a much more emphasis on spin and movement and understanding that. And I think for a guy like Nathan Eovaldi, as we all know, I mean, he's known for the heat, the velocity that he can bring. But to see his split finger, to see his breaking ball, to see his alternative secondary pitches and the emphasis that he was putting on those, understanding that he didn't have the velocity to just blow it by guys, almost makes you a better pitcher, especially as you heal. And of course that velocity gets back. You want to be able to have all the things, but that's one thing I've heard a lot of pitchers talk about, is sometimes when the velocity isn't there for whatever reason, it allows you to be more complete and understand the things that you really need to work on when you're looking at movement and location.
It's interesting because, as you know, earlier in Eovaldi's career, when he first was in the big leagues, he was known as an Iron Mike type pitcher. In other words, he could throw almost 100 miles an hour, but there was no movement. And so he would get hit harder than he was throwing. Yeah. But then as he's gone on, it's the great thing about baseball is players evolve, players change, players adapt. And he's over through the years been able to develop some movement. You know, there's a question in the National League, who's the better team, Dodgers or Mets? I think a lot of that's going to come down at the end of the year to the depth of the starting rotation. And Tony Gonsolin's been an important part of the Dodgers.
You know, it's almost like a secret weapon, because you look at, you know, all the big name starters that we've seen across the years with the Dodgers, and Tony Gonsolin has just been that steady Eddie. Like, he's been honestly their best starter when you look at consistency, you look at results. And this was a guy that didn't even know if he'd be in the starting rotation coming out of spring training. Remember, they were trying to decide, as they have the last couple of years, of course, a different story now, but they had so many options. And so Gonsolin was kind of like maybe the fifth guy. He could be the sixth. We might, you know, see him out of the bullpen. Instead, he has been the go-to and been able to give length. That was his biggest goal coming into the season. He actually sat down with Clayton Kershaw, worked with him in spring training to understand, how can I provide more innings? What am I doing wrong? And the biggest thing that stood out, and Clayton was a huge help in this, is like, you got to attack the strike zone more. You got to go after hitters and stop picking. And one of the things that Tony has done in the past is he's always had the stuff, always had, but as soon as he would start to get in trouble or face even better hitters, he'd start to pick around the plate and get a lot of walks constantly. That was kind of his thing. Or, you know, pitching a deep count. So he understood pitching to contact, getting and attacking hitters, and honestly how that puts them on the heels. And that has been paying dividends for the Dodgers. Saw it again in a big start this week. But being able to go 6+ innings consistently and giving up 2 or less runs in his last, gosh, 5 or 6 starts.
All right. So next week's segment, I want you to have a T-shirt that has your WRC plus on it. Sarah Abbott, jump in here. What would you guess her WRC plus was for her career? Because I'm thinking it was, you know, and I don't know your statistics off the top of my head, but I do know your reputation. I'm guessing it was 210. Sarah Abbott, you want to throw a number out there?
I'm going to guess 212 because of the Price is Right rules.
That's a bunch of crap right there. You're doing the Price is Right thing.
Price
is
Right
rules. That is not right.
Yep. That's why you shouldn't go first. Price is Right rules.
Yes. If it's over 200, I'd be pumped.
All right.
Thanks, Buster.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes!
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
All aboard. It's the Rabbit Train with Carl Ravitch on Baseball Tonight.
Carl Ravitch, play-by-play man for Sunday Night Baseball. The Rabbit Train this weekend will be in Anaheim, California, because we got the Mets, playing against the Angels. And Ravi, that the Angels, they stopped the bleeding for a night. You know, I talked to Perry Manassian, their general manager, last night, and he mentioned to me, you know, we're not this bad. Like, we're not dead.
I agree with him. I mean, I think that a lot of times you get caught up in 8, 10. I think when it grows to 14, it gets a little more concerning. But as I think I said to you guys during a conference call we had about Sunday Night Baseball, I mean, if they had lost 5 in a row, then won 1, and then lost 7 in a row, they would have lost 12 of 13 games. And it doesn't ever get counted as a 14 or 13 game losing streak because you broke it up with 1 win. So I didn't go too deep into this is just doomsday for the Angels, comparing it with other teams that have found themselves 3, 4, 5 games out of the wild card. And the Red Sox are certainly the example that are now in the wild card and would be a playoff team. I mean, the Angels, because of the way they banked wins in the early part of the season, are in fine shape. I mean, start the season now, do the Angels have a chance to get into the playoffs? Absolutely. Now, a lot of things have to go right, and they need guys to get healthy, but it's whether this is just a small Band-Aid that eventually falls off when you dive into the pool, or it's something that sticks for the rest of the season, that's kind of what remains to be seen.
As of this morning, the Angels 2.5 games behind the Red Sox for the third wild card spot. On that conference call yesterday, you mentioned the possibility of reaching out to Joe Maddon. What did you make of all that, Carl, the fact that they decided to move on from him?
Well, I'm not shocked by it. I think we had seen some of the tremors leading up to that decision, and they may have extended into, I don't know, last year, depending on what Perry's feelings were about some of the decisions, some of the discussions that were had. But, you know, I think the walking of Seager with the bases loaded intentionally was one to raise an eyebrow. You know, and I think a 14-game losing streak continues that. I think my takeaway from the whole thing, Buster, was I was surprised how aggressive Joe was in his post-firing comments about analytics and the role that they play in this game. Because it seemed like he tried to not be dismissive of them when he was very dismissive of them. And it was also interesting. I don't know if you saw the post-game comments from Phil Nevin last night after Ohtani pitched so well and hit the homer. He kind of fell back on, you know, you can see Ohtani's body language as one of the indicators as to how the game is going. And body language to me is kind of old school. He said with Ohtani, it's really the body language and to see how the swings are on him. And they weren't taking a lot of good swings. And in a lot of ways, that's Nev talking to me about baseball in the 1990s. And it's not about somebody who would look at Ohtani's spin rate or Ohtani's horizontal sweeping movement and say he had that pitch going. So there's this reliance on language that I think was once used that may have taken Perry back a little bit. Like, that's not how we communicate. That's not how we speak here in Angels land, or really in the Major League Baseball front offices and their managers anymore. So I thought it was interesting that Nevin went to the body language comment, but I think that's what is rooted in the decision to move Joe out. 14 games and some of those things add up to here's my chance, and I'm going to take it, and now it's really on me. And Perry's reshaped this entire team. He's reshaped the front office. He's reshaped the manager's office. Now it's on him.
I must say, when I read Joe's comments where he was, you know, pushing back against analytics, I felt like my instinct was he was kind of playing to stereotype a little bit. Because it's that whole, yeah, you know, we hear that dynamic between, well, you know, old school managers, you know, those guys are pushing uphill against people who only care about numbers. And there were a couple of things that were interesting about that to me. I think you would agree with me that 15 years ago, when Joe was with the Tampa Bay Rays, he was viewed as one of the most progressive managers. He was a guy who was viewed as being, you know, being open to applying defensive shift, for example. He was someone who was willing to do some of the stuff that the Rays did in terms of roster construction. And the other thing, too, and we talked about this on the conference call yesterday, Perry Manassian is not he's not a numbers guy. Like, that is not his background. He grew up basically in the Texas Rangers clubhouse where his dad worked. He got to know Buck Showalter, who's like his patron saint in baseball, because he liked the work that Perry did. Perry's more of a field guy, I feel like. And he likes, you know, culture and mixing the right players and adding the right player at the right time. He's not a guy, when you talk to him, who's talking about, you know, what some guy's, exit velocity is on Tuesdays. And that's part of the reason why I was a little bit surprised by what Joe said.
Yeah, I think it's a great question to ask Joe. As one of the guys that were on the front line of these things back with Tampa, and now that everybody else has, in his, I think, opinion, and we'd have to ask him, gone overboard with the original intent in his idea of what analytics meant, and yes, we will shift because it makes sense, and sure, we'll use Ben Zobrist all over the field, and yes, we'll platoon guys. I just think that Joe's impression of analytics is to use them to a degree, but not, and I think he believes, fall on the sword of analytics when you are making, and I think he said it, every baseball decision. And I think if you look around baseball today, and I don't know if you agree with this, but it feels like the managers whose organizations use analytics probably more than they had or have been exposed to analytics, like Bob Melvin, more than he was in Oakland, now with San Diego. Remember, he told us analytics, that's just baked into the equation that we all use here, is a tip of the cap to, yep, I'm in on it. I'm not necessarily going to be able to explain it to you people in exact detail like somebody who's involved in the numbers might, but I know it's important and it's all part of what we do here. That's the answer to analytics. It's all part of what we do here, as opposed to dismissing the role that they play, which I think in Joe's comments, while again, he hedges saying, I know how important they are, but the idea that you have a but in capital letters is I think off-putting to front offices. I'm surprised. I'm not sure who runs out and hires somebody who just made that comment, because as our buddy Sarah Langs has pointed out many times, the challenge with trying to criticize analytics is they are fact-based and they work. They make sense. They are proving a point sort of beyond a reasonable doubt that if you do this, it's going to work for you. I mean, how many pitchers have these organizations, the Giants, the Yankees currently, the Pirates, the Rays, taken guys who were fringe players, fringe pitchers, put them in a lab, showed them if you hold the ball with this amount of pressure and throw it at this angle, not that one, but this one, you maximize your efficiency and you're a much better pitcher. They work. And that's, I think, the part that drives people who are reluctant to embrace them crazy. And I'll be honest, I was one of those. I wasn't somebody who denied them. I probably didn't understand them to the degree that I do now. And analytics are not going away because they just make sense. It's like, in a lot of ways, it's like science. Sometimes you want to not believe the science. You've got to believe them. There's a reason that they're here and they work.
I agree with you. I would say this, and we don't know exactly what Joe was referring to. You know, the next time I talk to him, the next time you talk to him, maybe we can dig into that with him. But I'll give you an example of how analytics really potentially affected the trajectory of one of the teams that he worked with. The Chicago Cubs, like a lot of teams, manipulated service time with Chris Bryant. Like, they absolutely sliced to the edge. Okay, if we keep in the minor leagues this long, then we can back up when he becomes a free agent. And Carl, I absolutely believe that affected the relationship, not only between Bryant and the Cubs, but that whole group. I think it infected that group with some cynicism, maybe, you know, robbing the whole group of some joy. Joe Maddon, you know, led that team to a championship in 2016. It fell apart after that for that team slowly. And I'll always wonder if the manipulation of Bryant's service time had something to do with that. And so that, I don't know, that maybe he's referring to.
I hear you, but I would say this, Buster, if that is in fact the hill of analytics that he is choosing to kind of die on.
Right.
I would say that in the most recent collective bargaining agreement, the two sides at least addressed it publicly. Certain organizations obviously seem to still ignore it and don't care
yes.
about it. Others, I think, have promoted players. And I would look at that 2016 Cubs team as one that was put together with analytics in mind, because that's how Theo thinks.
Yep.
And yet what it needed was this massaging that Joe brought, which is the non-analytic part of it. That's where the whole baked-in concept works. Analytically, they were strong. What they needed was the other side. He accomplished that, and maybe he looks at it like, see, I told you, I wasn't thinking analytics. I was thinking what I bring to the table, but the formula was the recipe. The ingredients of analytically driven team was already there, and he took the next step. The service time manipulation, to me, isn't what current analytics is necessarily about with regards to organizations.
Oh, I do. I do, absolutely. I'll give you an example. Who was it last year?
Tanner the Orioles. Houck.
Okay, no. Yeah. I'll give you an example. Tanner Houck last year, he made 5 starts in the big leagues. You know how many days of service time he was credited with for 5 starts in the big leagues? 5 days. He was sent to the minor league. He was called up and sent down repeatedly up and down. That's part of analytics as well, you know? And I agree with you. I think there's a lot of it that's great in terms of decision, but I also think front offices have gone too far in some cases, like you mentioned the Orioles before I cut you off, where it's like, dude, you can do some of that stuff, but if you're surprised that the players begin to look at organizations with some cynicism when you handle it that way, then you're not paying attention.
Right. But I do think we're blurring it a little bit, because I think the cynicism from the players in those situations comes from the fact, and I agree with the players, you are not putting your best product on the field. That alone sucks. And that needs to be addressed. And I think there's a beginning effort from both sides to address it. The analytics part that the Yankees pitchers are seeing, or the Giants, or the defensive shifts, or all that, any player, not manager, but any player who looks at that and says, this doesn't make sense, this isn't working, is going to fall behind. You know, in a sense, they're not going to be promoted. You don't want to listen to this stuff. You don't want to make yourself better. You're not even going to be on the major league field. You don't have to worry about us promoting you, because you're not doing what's best for you as a player.
Yep.
The blur is that the let's not bring up this guy is a financial deal. The analytics suggest, why the hell would I pay him an extra year when I can have him an extra year? Business-wise, I understand that. But from a perspective of, are we doing what's best for the organization, this fan base? How are we making ourselves better? It's not by leaving him down in AAA or AA this season. That helps you guys in year 6. It doesn't do anything for the team that's on the field this season. And that part, I think, is where service time manipulation is awful and needs to be done away with.
Yeah, right. You know, Jesse Rogers and I talked last week about an example. Grayson Rodriguez, a great pitching prospect for the Orioles.
Yes.
Completely dominated the first 2 months. He should have been in the big leagues. He should have been able to have started his major league career. And instead, they held him down the minor leagues, and then he got hurt. And now it looks like he's going to miss maybe the rest of this season, and the Orioles can go, well, next year we have to get him back on. Give me a break. They basically stole money from the kid.
Right. So. See you in Nashville when he's able to pitch, right?
Speaking of which, and before we move on from this Sunday's game, Mike Trout wearing a microphone for us this weekend. That'll be great. From what I hear about his injury, they're hopeful that he's going to come back on Friday, but there is an expectation that he will play in our game on Sunday, and it'll be fun for you guys to have a conversation with him. About the Orioles, there was a story that was published by the Baltimore Banner that Lou Angelos, one of Peter Angelos' 2 sons, has sued his brother and his mother over the fact that, according to Lou, John Angelos has taken full control of the team despite their father intending for both sons to have equal control. The suit also claims that Lewis's mother, George Angelos, has wanted to sell the team. Carl, that I got to say, as someone who covered the Orioles and knew Peter well, back in the 90s, this is not a surprise. But it's an absolute mess. And I think from Major League Baseball's perspective, it's a worst case scenario.
Well, it is. And I think, you know, as you know, and you read that article and you know the Orioles as well as anyone from your days there and the Angelos family, look, there's a bit of a Steinbrenner feel to this thing. I think anytime this is like owning a home and having multiple children. What do you do with the future of the home and who owns it? And should it just be sold and then let them figure that out? There's so many layers to this, including, I think, that the owners had ultimately handed one of the brothers control of the team.
John has control of the team.
Well, right away, you're setting up this idea that you're taking what the dad's wishes were, which was this was 50-50, and handing control to one of the two. So all of a sudden, the scales are tipped in favor of John away from Louis. And I, you know, if I'm Louis, I'm wondering, well, what is happening here? This is not the wish of the man that owns the team. We have 50% control, and that seems to, if somebody is told you're in charge, you have control, that ain't 50-50 in my world. And this idea that perhaps Mom and Louis are thinking about, John, are thinking about selling this for what's now valued at, what, $1 billion versus the $170 million he bought it for? Again, this is service time manipulation from an organization. They want to sell the team and make $1 billion on it or $800 million profit. I understand that business-wise. I get it. Doesn't mean that I would agree with it. And if I'm Louis, I'm certainly not happy with it. But this when you invite family dynamics and percentages of team and wills and trusts and estates and all these things into it, you're taking it from the diamond to the courtroom. And that's where this is going.
Yeah, and if you're a fan of what they're building on the field, how this could be affected moving forward is that the fight between the two brothers could absolutely restrict the payroll. We already know that in recent years they've tanked and they've cut their payroll to the bone. And moving forward, as this collection of young players evolves, the question of whether or not we're going to add to that team is going to be affected by this fight, however long it takes. One of the allegations made in that lawsuit by Lou is that John would like to move the team to Nashville, where John lives. And you know, Carl, I always pay attention to that because I went to school there. I lived in Nashville for 8 years. I think it, you know, if you asked me the question, 10 years, do I think that Nashville is going to have a major league team? Absolutely. But I think it's going to be through expansion. I do not think it's going to be a case where the other owners would say, yeah, go ahead. Take that team out of Baltimore, take that team out of Camden Yards and stick it in Nashville. And we'll just give away to you one of our potential expansion spots. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the same way airplanes get lined up on runways, I think there are teams currently that would move or be considered to be moved before Baltimore. I mean, I think Oakland and Tampa certainly come to mind. Yep. That if that were the way that Nashville gets a team, by the way, you're fourth in line, you're third in line for takeoff. You're not, to me, first in line for takeoff. And I do think expansion is coming. And I do think Las Vegas and Nashville, Tennessee, and perhaps Montreal are all on the list of places where these teams or new teams are going to relocate. I think a lot of times, Buster, in these situations, things are said, accusations are made, which may or may not be true, but it's just another way to kind of build your case, which is, again, going to end up in the courts and or on Rob Manfred's desk, because this is a potential headache coming down the road, as you said, that this is going to damage the competitive integrity of the Orioles and certainly the teams that are in their division, let alone their league.
It breaks my heart for Oriole fans. Again, yes. Having lived there and covered the Orioles for a couple of years, knowing how passionate that fan base is, knowing that in recent years they've lived through this tanking, the idea that all that hope might disappear through this legal fight, it really is awful. And you do wonder what kind of condition that market's going to be in by the time all the dust settles around this lawsuit between the two brothers. All right, before we go, Carl, I've got a Bleacher tweet for you. This is from Debbie Gammons Brown, who asked the question, can't decide who loves baseball more, Sarah Langs or Tim Kirkchin? Who's got your vote, Carl? Because I sent on a tweet in response the other day that the only person I know who loves baseball more than Sarah Langs, in my experience being around baseball, maybe was Don Zimmer. Like, he when he woke up every day, his whole life was around baseball. Sarah has such a passion for this sport. I think she's got more passion for it than even Tim. What do you think?
It's a great question. I think if I were to answer, there's two ways to answer it, and I'm not hedging here, and I'll get to the ultimate answer. But I think, you know, given the years that Tim has spent in and around it, it's almost like a relationship that Sarah has yet to recognize can be soured a little bit. Tim has seen the beauty of baseball, and he has seen the other side of it. In Sarah's case, she's, you know, so young and so enthusiastic and grew up with parents and grandparents who love the sport that it's almost like she lives in a perpetual honeymoon phase when it comes to baseball, which is the greatest phase of any relationship, where Tim has realized that there are some scars and there are some bruises and there are some dimples and pimples on this sport.
Ugliness
that,
underneath.
That really, that ugliness that kind of offend him. So I'd say that currently it's a draw on who loves it more, but Sarah's feelings about the game are still one of complete love and amorous. And Tim has realized, yeah, it's like a relationship. You know, I love the game, but boy, there are days I don't like it at all. I hate it. I don't think Sarah's felt that very much.
Carl, I was going to say, there's no doubt that that Sarah, Tim, I concede the fact that they love the game more than I do. Would you say that for yourself?
Yeah, I think that Sarah's got some blinders on, and Tim is just such a romantic about it. But I will acknowledge that because of the way this sport has impacted my life, it is a love relationship. I don't ever hate it, but there are days where I'm like, why are we doing this to ourselves as a sport? We're making mistakes. We're killing ourselves. That's the part that I don't get. It's not all, you know, chocolate and roses, but boy, it is something that I'm incredibly passionate about and do love on most days, but not the way they do. I would agree.
Yeah, I think the pandemic absolutely reminded you and I of how great it is to be on a baseball field and to talk with players and have great conversations. Because that when I was able to start to do that, especially last year, it was like, oh, thank God. That was like lifeblood.
Yeah.
Take care. Travel safe. I'll see you out in Anaheim.
Okay. See you soon. Thank you.
Bleacher Tweets.
All right, Buster, it's time for Bleacher Tweets. The first one comes from Braden at Hoodie Braden. Is it an overstatement to say that the combination of Hunter Green and Graham Ashcraft is the best rookie starting pitching combo in the league? I know hot bats are mostly to thank for the Reds' record improvement, but Green and Graham are no joke.
Yeah, and I talked to Nick Kroll, their general manager, on the eve of the season. He talked about how he really felt good about the young pitching they had coming up. Think about Ashcraft so far this season. One home run allowed in 23 and two-thirds innings with a 1.14 ERA. And Hunter Green, in those innings when he's able to command the ball and be dominant, wow. I mean, he just controls hitters. It's fun to watch.
Our next one comes from Mitchell at Tigers of Detroit. Is Jose Ramirez being overlooked in the MVP conversation? Most of the talk has been around Judge. Is that due to their markets, or has Judge been that much better?
Judge has been that much better. I mean, Judge is on a pace to hit over 60 home runs. First guy to do it in two decades. That's going to dominate the conversation as we go along this summer.
Next up is Kyle Betting. We've already seen the Phillies and Angels make a managerial change. How much longer do the White Sox have to underperform their expectations before La Russa is in the hot seat on the south side of Chicago?
So Jerry Reinsdorf, the White Sox owner, is the most loyal person in baseball, and everybody knows it, which is why he brought La Russa back. He felt bad about firing him decades ago. I would be absolutely shocked if he were to fire La Russa in season. That's just not his style.
All right. And our last one comes from Frank. Hi, everyone. Any numbers that really jump out to you for Sandy Alcantara? He's been carrying my fantasy pitching staff, and I love how he keeps throwing deep into the games.
Yeah, Frank, I looked up the stats on him after I saw your tweets, And I was like, I didn't realize he had already racked up 83 and two thirds innings, which leads the majors. And he's faced the most hitters this year, 320. He is building an unbelievable season.
All right. That's it for Bleacher Tweets. Be sure to rate and review this podcast and submit your questions using hashtag Bleacher Tweets. And be sure to check us out on YouTube every Monday. Just a subtle reminder. Buster, keep tweeting them out because you know who follows you on Twitter. That's right. Tell the class.
Miles Teller,
a.k.a. Rooster from Top Gun Maverick. Thanks.
Oh, you are so fired up about that. He's a big baseball fan. It is cool. You know what? Yeah, Miles Teller is a huge sports fan, and that's why he's following me, not because of anything I did, just because he loves to follow sports. Did you see his first pitch last week? Pretty cool in Philadelphia.
Oh, did I see it? I've seen everything he has done. I am a Miles Teller stan. Miles, if you are listening to this, hello, welcome.
Well, that's it for today. That's it for this week. My thanks to Sarah, Carl, Jess, and Hembo. And thanks to you, the listeners. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality is something we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, check out the Fantasy Focus podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. The Baseball Tonight podcast.